Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, why Vietnam still matters 50 years later. On November 5th, four Vietnam veterans sat on a panel at the Monroe County History Center and discussed their service along with why Vietnam is still important today. Local Vietnam veterans included Phil Zook, Catherine Peacock, Jim Cryway, and Jim Follett. Veteran and filmmaker Ron Osgood moderated the panel. Panelists discussed their time abroad along with what it was like to return home after their service. This audio was provided courtesy of Community Access Television Services. As a warning, this episode contains some sensitive material about wartime. We begin the show with a quick introduction from a staff member at the History Center.
Welcome to the History Center, everyone, even though I think there's more people up here. I'm the Education Manager, Erin, and I appreciate everyone being here. I want to introduce Ron Osgood. He is a former IU professor, right? Okay, thought I had that right. And he's now a filmmaker and does a lot with veterans, so he is also a Vietnam veteran, and that's why he is our moderator for this panel. And I'm going to pass it over to him and let him introduce the rest of our panel. Thank you.
Thanks, Erin. Thanks to the History Center for providing this opportunity for us to do this. The first thing I always like to ask when I'm in a panel or talking about something dealing with Vietnam is if I could get a show of hands from the other veterans in the audience. Boom, boom, boom. So there's four Vietnam veterans that are in the audience. So that makes, you know, a overwhelming amount of the people here. And so thanking everybody being here today with us. I want to start by reading a short passage from a book. And I'm going to preface it from a book by Tim O'Brien called The Things They Carry. And I don't know if any of you have read this book or not, but I highly recommend it as a really interesting book about Tim O'Brien, an award-winning writer in his time in Vietnam. The Things They Carried. I'm just going to read the first sentence of the book. First Lieutenant Jimmy Cross carried letters from a girl named Martha, a junior at Mount Sebastian College in New Jersey. So what the first chapter of his book does is sets the stage to see the kinds of personal things that people would carry with them when they were deployed. I'm going to turn that to a book called Smile on Your Brother. This is a story of Timmy Fitzmaurice. I was a friend of his in elementary school, and he was killed in Vietnam in 1968. I'm going to read a paragraph from his book. In the introductory vignette of O'Brien's work, The Things They Carried, the author described each of the book's major characters by detailing what they carried with them into battle, from physical items such as canteens and grenades and lice, to emotions of fear and love. Tim Fitzmaurice carried Kool-Aid to make the water taste tolerable, and mosquito repellent to keep the bugs away. He carried a rosary and a miraculous medal. He carried letters from his mother and photos of Cindy. Cindy is his girlfriend. And he carried a toy. And that's what I wanted to read and wanted to finish with that line. And he carried a toy. And the author who wrote the book and his family knows nothing about what that toy was. All they know is when they got the descriptions of what came back, the list said a toy or the word toy. But I think it's a really good introduction to what it's like to be a 17, 18, or slightly older young man or woman going into the military, that in some ways we still have our toys, right? Our toys. So I use that as kind of my introduction. So I want to acknowledge the fact that not only do we have the veterans out here in the group in this, and we have this group here, but I'm going to do a really, really brief introduction and let them fill in the blanks and just tell a little bit about their service, and then we'll turn to discussions of things that are on your minds and some of the things that we've given a little bit of thought, not a lot, but a little bit of thought of ahead of time. So starting right here on my right is Dr. James La Follette. Jim was a lieutenant in the Navy, but he served with the Marines when he was in Vietnam. And he was in Quezon during the 77-day siege. Next is Jim Criway. Jim was a captain, and he was in Vietnam. I'm sorry, Jim was there in 67, 68. Jim Criway was in 70, 71. He was in the 1st Cavalry, and he was a helicopter pilot. He also went into Cambodia. Next is Kathy Peacock. Kathy was in the Army Nursing Corps. She was at the 3rd Field Hospital by Saigon, or in Saigon, working in surgical nursing in 70 and 71. And Phil Zook was a lieutenant when he went in the Army. When he went to Vietnam, he was there in 69 and 70 in the 1st Cavalry, and he also went into Cambodia during the Cambodia incursion in the spring of 1970. So that's this panel. I guess I should say why I'm doing this. So I was in the Navy. I was on an aircraft carrier, the USS Oriskany. I was in the 7th Fleet for 3 deployments on Yankee and Dixie stations off the coast of Vietnam, providing air support to some of the things that these folks were doing. And so that's my story. So I'm going to open it up to let them give kind of their brief introductions of what they did and where they were, and we'll go from there. Jim, please.
Well, I got there in July of 1968, or 67, and when I got my notice that I was going to be in the military, they said I was going to be in the South Pacific in the Navy, and I thought, hey, I can handle that, you know, and they said, you don't understand, and they're right, I didn't understand. Because that meant I was going to be with the Marines. So I got in the country and landed in Da Nang, immediately went to Phu Bai, which is where the medical battalion was. And the admiral up there in charge of all the doctors was greeting everybody. I think there was 80 of them that came in that day. And he had a sheet of paper with all everybody that had just come in, and he was going down looking at everybody, and they came up, and he got to my name, and he says, where's La Follette? And I thought, oh. And he says, I understand where you took your training. He says, I can send you everywhere, anywhere. And I did do my training at the Marion County General Hospital and saw a lot of trauma and gunshot wounds and just about everything that would walk in the door. And so I can kind of understand why he said that. But it was a... That's all right. I mean, I was a young doctor, and was drafted, and I thought, well, they shouldn't take somebody out of an established practice. I thought they should take the young guys that are there, and I was pretty interested in outdoor life. I did a lot of camping as I was growing up, plus I had Army ROTC for 2 years and Air Force ROTC for 2 years, and just did a lot of stuff, you know, and so... I don't think I was afraid to go into the military, but I didn't know what all I was in for. And so the first week I was in Phu Bai with the Med Battalion, it was the triage area. And the first day of triage that we had 110 casualties brought in the first day, and 27 were amputees, anywhere from 1 to 4 extremities blown off, and some of the god-awfulest wounds I ever saw, people shot in the face and just anything imaginable. And I walked out of the triage area after that, and I thought, you know, I don't know if I can do that. You know, I mean, it was pretty gross. And I'd seen a lot of stuff, but I hadn't seen the volume and the extent of the injuries like I saw there. And after doing the triage, why I was allocated to give anesthesia. When I was there, they said, has anybody given anesthesia? And I said, well, in my training, we did a little bit. So I became an anesthesiologist also. And after that, I went to the 3rd Engineer Battalion, and it was just outside of Phu Bai. And after that, I was sent to the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines. And when I was... allocated to them. The next day they went to Quezon, and that's when I got all my experiences, I'd say. You know, I was in a foxhole for a while, like everybody else, and we had a triage area up there, which was about, I'd say, 15 by 15, and it was above ground, and that got blown away, I think, the second day we were there. So it was just a lot of trauma that I saw. And this guy over here sprayed Agent Orange on me, I found out later on.
And but, he smiled doing it, too, let me tell you. Mm-hmm.
We took care of all kinds of people, the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, civilians, Koreans. I had an Australian Special Forces group that was with us, and we also did MedCap stuff there. Well, I'll let you go ahead, Jim. And
okay. Thanks, Jim.
Well, I'm sitting between two people I'm glad I didn't visit in Vietnam, one doctor and one nurse, that's for sure. I was drafted when I was teaching school here in Bloomington, and I decided that I would want to delay going to Vietnam as long as I could. Maybe the war would be over, but that didn't happen because I ended up going to Fort Benning and went to I was training Rangers, and then I was getting close to have orders, and I said, maybe I'll volunteer to flight school, and I took the exam and end up going to flight school and end up being a helicopter pilot, and then I couldn't delay it. Got to Vietnam, and one unit I didn't want to be assigned to was the 1st Cav because they had been taking a lot of casualties, and what did I get assigned to? The 1st Cav. We're in south of Song Bay in Three Corps area. Flew a lot. I probably had 12 to 1,500 hours of flying in Vietnam. Saw most of Three Corps, saw a little Two Corps. Days were anywhere from 8 to 10 hours long, flying, that is. And we did everything. It was a utility helicopter company. So we would fly in troops on combat assaults. We would kick out supplies. One mission I had was spraying for mosquitoes. One time I was flying out, and I had a chemical corps officer on board the helicopter, and he had these two hoses sticking out the side, and he was sniffing out there trying to find people going down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. I was in probably the first helicopter to go into Cambodia during the Cambodian insurgency. In that insertion, the next day, we had 20 helicopters in the section I was in that I controlled. The next day, we were down to two. And it took us a couple weeks to get back up to the rest because it was easy to shoot down helicopters. It was an experience that I won't forget.
Well, I wasn't in anywhere near the danger that any of you guys were in at all because I was in Saigon. I was very disappointed because everybody else that I was in training with got sent out to more outpost-type things, and I got sent to the city-type hospital. The hospital had been an orphanage run by Catholic sisters before the Army took it over, and so all the classrooms were turned into wards, and they did build a concrete block building that became the surgery department and the emergency room. And so it was much more civilized. We were about half a mile from Tanzanut Air Force Base, which was the big Air Force Base for the country, really. So we took care of, we did get casualties on a daily basis because we took casualties that were probably beyond the scope of what some of the smaller hospitals could handle because we had more equipment and we had the only kidney dialysis machine in the country and some things like that. So we got some difficult cases. But we also did typical surgery like you would have in any hospital. We did hemorrhoid surgery and we did hernia surgeries and, you know, the typical stuff that happens to people in daily life. So we had kind of a real mix of things. We worked 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, 7 to 7. Either in the morning or at night, it didn't matter. And then we took call in addition to that. So the days went by pretty quickly because you just stayed busy. I wasn't under the duress that anybody else was under. We did, however, we were right across the street from the Army of Vietnam National Headquarters for the Vietnamese Army, and they would take pot shots at us at night when we were on call, a little sniper activity, so you never knew if they were drinking or high or what, and they would just decide to have practice. But I was never in the kind of danger that everybody was in. I think the hardest part for me was I was 21, and almost everybody that came through that was injured was 18 or 19, and I had an 18-year-old brother. And so you just see your family member, cousins, brothers, whatever, in everybody that came through, and you take that with you. So I think the hardest visual thing that I had is when I first got to understand a triage area, it's just rows and rows of cots, maybe 20 or more cots. There's a sprinkler system up above the cots, at least this is how it was in Third Field. And when we'd get a whole bunch of casualties, they would just put everybody on these cots and turn on the sprinklers, because most of the fellas were full of mud, and the only way you could find out where their injuries were was to clean the mud off. And that was the most optically traumatic thing to me, to see that going on, because you just, that's so different than a civilian emergency room. But it was the quickest way to see what the problem was and then to proceed to take care of whatever you needed to. So, you know, it's just a totally different experience than any of you had.
Taking the malaria pills probably was an occupational hazard for hemorrhoid surgery.
I forgot those.
That's right. There actually was TV. There was American Forces TV in Vietnam, and one of the commercials was, "Have you had your pill today?" And it was the malaria pills.
Phil?
I grew up in northern Indiana. I'm the son of a World War II veteran. Came to Indiana University in 1964. At that time, ROTC was compulsory for all males, so everybody went through ROTC for at least 2 years, I think it was at that time, and they discontinued that sometime while I was here. 64 was a considerably different time. It was before a big buildup for Vietnam, and so I think in 64 my thoughts were not on Vietnam. They were just kind of on IU. I stayed in ROTC. I was commissioned in January of 1969 with the USAR Commission. I was offered an RA Commission. I was thinking about making it a career at that time. I accepted the RA Commission, was commissioned April of 1969, RA Infantry. And I went to Fort Benning, my first duty station, went through training there, jump school. In December of 1969, I was deployed to Vietnam. I went to the 1st Cav Division, and I think Jim said sort of tongue-in-cheek he didn't want to go there, but the 1st Cav was a pretty good division to go to, and I was very happy to be going to the 1st Cav. I was a platoon leader with Charlie Company, 1st of the 7th Cav, up on the Cambodian border out of Quan Loi was our brigade rear. We worked out of a fire base. From January until May, we worked on the Cambodian border. In May of 1970, we went into Cambodia. And about 12 days after going into Cambodia, I was wounded. I was medevaced out of Cambodia. I went through the 24th Evac Hospital in Ben Hoa.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm happy to have doctors and nurses that served in Vietnam. I was well cared for at the 24th Evac, eventually sent to the 249th General Hospital, Camp Drake in Japan. When I woke up one time, I remember a nurse holding my hand after surgery. I remember back at the 24th Evac, we took a lot of casualties. There were a number of casualties, and the gurneys were just kind of lined up down the hall of the hospital, and at the end was the doors to the hospital room. And I remember the last thing before or after going through the door, there's three doctors in there. I was wounded by shrapnel, so I had wounds in my face and my arms, leg, back, head, and the doctors were trying to decide how each one of them wanted me on the table to operate on at the same time. And after I was taken from Japan to Great Lakes Naval Hospital, I spent the summer in the hospital recovering from wounds, went back on active duty in September of 1970. I stayed on active duty until March of 1973. I got out as a captain and came back to Indiana University to go to grad school.
Thank you. I wonder if there's any questions or clarification from the audience. Yes, sir.
The lady that was a nurse, how many years did you stay in the military?
I was in for a total of 5 years, but I served in Vietnam for 1 year from March of 70 to March of 71.
Did you stay with the as a nurse? Did you stay yes. within the...
Yes, I was a surgery nurse, and I've done that for 40 years till I retired.
Oh, wow. I belong to the... we have a meeting here a while back, and there's a lady, a nurse here out in town or something. She was a nurse at Saigon, and she was involved, you know, when they airlifted the children, you know, the big...
72.
Yeah, she was a nurse that was at Saigon.
Oh my gosh!
When they started processing the children, you know, the flight, you know, there was what
freedom
about a thousand,
freedom flight, exactly.
About 1,500 of them flew back, you know, and she was part of the giving medical stuff,
to meet her.
Checking the kids out before they put them on flight, and they were, you know, they was orphans, I guess.
Right.
I guess there's quite a few of them.
Yeah.
But I guess she worked at the hospital at Saigon.
You've been listening to Why Vietnam Still Matters 50 Years Later on Standing Room Only on WFHB. Listening to a panel hosted by the Monroe County History Center on why Vietnam still matters 50 years later. Veterans Phil Zook, Catherine Peacock, Jim Cryway, and Jim Follett, along with Ron Osgood, sat on the panel on November 5th. This audio was provided courtesy of Community Access Television Services. As a warning, this episode contains some sensitive material about wartime. We return now to an audience question.
Else? Any other questions or comments? So one of the things that I think most of them in this group, it's a slightly different mix of people than I thought we would have. I thought we might have some more younger people so we could talk about some other things that you're probably pretty much aware of. But I think it's still important to talk just real briefly. We don't all have to comment, but if anybody has any anecdotal stories about coming home. Because we hear a lot of different stories, and I'm going to ask Jim Cryway to tell his story first.
Oh, wow.
I read it somewhere, so that's why I know he's got an interesting story.
Which part do you want to hear?
San Francisco.
The best part was getting on an airplane, leaving Vietnam.
Yeah. So that's how that's the feeling. You get on an airplane, but then you land in San Francisco.
People try to spit on you.
Yeah, so the baby killer kind of a thought. So, you know, that's pretty a pretty hard thing to for someone to come home, and because in Vietnam, as most of us know, individual replacements, you would go in country usually potentially on your own, and you would come home alone, and you would be sent. You'd come into an airport and sort of have this feeling of I've landed in the States, and then potentially have, you know, this kind of activity.
Well, it was in Oakland, you know, and the people in Oakland just didn't support the war.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anybody else? Stories?
My recollection is about coming back. I came back through the hospital system, flew out of Japan, and flew into Glenview Naval Air Station in Chicago. And then was bused, and I wasn't ambulatory, but I was fortunate enough that my litter was, when they put us on the bus, was high enough that I could look out the window, and I was headed to Great Lakes Naval Hospital eventually. And I remember going through whatever part of Chicago that was and passing by an elementary school and just thinking to myself, you know, how is this possible? you know, how come the world is going on the same way? And here, though it had been several weeks since I'd been wounded and gone through the hospital, but, you know, there's such a different experience going on in Vietnam at that time. I always comment that, you know, in Vietnam we always talked about back in the world, wanting to go back in the world. And I think that was a phrase that really fit well because the Vietnam experience, the combat experience, was unworldly for most of us. We understood civilian life, and we'd been well trained in the military, but then when you got over there, and something that you've mentioned about the yearly replacement, you were immersed into a situation and immediately you just kind of hit the ground and you were expected to do your job. And for me, it was an abrupt end as far as it goes for being wounded, medevaced out of the field, back through the hospitals. But for other guys, it was an abrupt end because their DROS came up. Mm-hmm. Their separation came up. And guys actually, in some cases, left the field and within 72 hours may have been back in the States. And, you know, how I had enough trouble getting my head around being back in the United States after 3 weeks. I don't know how you do it after 3 days.
Well, let me.
Was there no debriefing?
No.
No. So my daughter was in the Marines, but during the Iraq War. But she came home and she had this huge debriefing kind of eased into. No.
I think that's one of the things that make Vietnam so much different,
right.
Because it was, I believe, the only war that was individual replacements, 1 year at a time,
right.
Where you look at situations like World War II, units were trained
whole
in the
units,
state,
right.
They went over as a whole unit,
right.
And they came back as a whole unit, and many times there was more time to decompress. They came back on ships. There was a system of coming home from Europe that was based upon points, how much time you'd been there, and combat experience and those sort of things. So men had a certain amount of time back in the rear after the conflict had ended in Europe to decompress and to sort memories out and those sort of thing. And it just it was never the case in Vietnam from
right.
the beginning to the end
right.
that there was any sort of a process. And I really fault the government because I think it's something that was, you know, patently obvious that there should have been some sort of a decompression. There should have been some sort of a way in which individuals could sort their lives out, but different war, different time.
Yeah. I can remember getting to Vietnam. I get off the airplane, and they had a line of people getting ready to get on the airplane to go back to the States. And so they'd say, have fun. They'd get on the airplane, and they were gone. And they said, welcome to Vietnam. And then they'd stick you on a truck and send you someplace. And that was your welcome to Vietnam. And the other guys had a big smile on their face because they were leaving.
I think because I came home much a year and a half, 2 years after most everybody else, by that time the protests were so, I don't know, so bad that we weren't allowed to wear our uniforms home. So even though as a young person, I was proud to join the military. My dad had served. My uncle had served. My uncle was a prisoner of war during World War II. I mean, we had a family history of serving. And then we came back, and I had to hide the fact that I had been in the military. And I didn't tell employers or anything probably for well over 5 years that I had been in the military because there was so much bad feeling in the country about everybody was lumped together, like you said, the baby killers or whatever. People would, if they did happen to find out, if it came out that I had served, you got a real bad vibe from everybody, like you were at fault. And most of us who went were young and naive and innocent and really believed that we were doing the best to fight communism and, doing something good for our country. And then we had to hide it or take the consequences.
I remember when we left, they were starting the racial riots in the States. And I took my training at Marion County General Hospital in Indianapolis. And while I was there, the shopping center across the street from the hospital was burnt down in a racial riot. And then when I was at Quezon, we'd get the USO newspaper, the main thing we'd hear about was the racial riots going on in Detroit and all, and I thought, what am I doing here when this is going on at home? And it was pretty upsetting to me to know what was going on back home. And when we were at KSUN, we were so tuned into our senses, you know. And if there's a loud noise or if you'd hear a swoosh in the air, it was probably incoming, and so you'd hit the ground, you know. Or if somebody else moved quickly, they were trying to avoid something like that. So we all did, you know. We'd be walking along, and everybody hit the ground, you know, and or you'd hear the sound, and it would just, you know, if you heard that sound, why, there's a good chance it was incoming or something like that coming on. And when I came back to the States, I can remember going to the hospital. I was at Great Lakes Naval Hospital doing orthopedics. And I would, if I was either walking down the street or in the hospital and somebody closed the door or a fluorescent bulb popped, why, I was ready to hit the ground, you know. I mean, you're so tuned into that. So, and when I landed in the States, I actually felt like getting down and kissing the runway, because it was one of those things where I was glad to be home, because we had been in so much trauma and the stuff I saw I really was glad to get back. And so it's kind of a mixed bag. I wanted to get back, but I was unhappy with what was going on here.
So in 1968, I was drafted, and I decided to join the Navy. The consequence was 4-year commitment instead of 2. So I didn't get out until 1972. I had found a program that the Navy had that allowed you to apply and get accepted into a college and be able to get out 90 days early. And I applied, got out, because the college was in its third week, I had a letter, you know, that from the admissions office that I would take to the teachers in my classes. And I came back, I flew back on a Pan Am mm-hmm. flight. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, that flying from the Navy, I had a 2 or 3 puddle jumper flights to get to, I think, Clark Air Force Base is where I got on the Pan Am flight. And I was, as everyone was, excited to be back on that plane. And sitting in the seat next to me was an officer, an Army officer. And we had no connection with each other. And I was just kind of intimidated that this officer was next to me. And he was probably intimidated of me because I'm, you know, no, I'm joking. There was supposed to be a laugh from the audience when I said that line. I didn't play it right, I guess. But I got to, I had to go to San Francisco as well. I didn't, in the Navy, of course, we at that time were able to grow beards. And our hair, we could have our hair a little bit longer. Since I worked on the flight deck occasionally in my job, we used to be able to grow our hair even longer because we would wear skull caps on our head all the time, 24/7.
It didn't work.
Yeah. And so I got to the San Francisco airport, and we all did, you know, I ditched my uniform in a bag and put on civilian clothes and was able to get from San Francisco back to Chicago and back home, and my mom had put a big sign up, welcome home. So it was this wonderful thing of coming home to my family. That was on a weekday, late afternoon, early evening when I arrived, and the next morning I went to college because I was 3 weeks late and I couldn't afford one more day, and I went into my class that first day. It might have been the first class I went into. I just remember over 4 years how the people that were my friends, we'd grown further apart each year because of our experiences. My friends in my immediate group had gone into the military. And so it was kind of a unique. And I went to the college, and it's my first day out. I'm very nervous, and everybody's younger than you are, so you sort of feel a little bit out. And I walked into this class, and I went up to the teacher, showed him the note, and the class was basic guitar. And he looked at my sheet, and he said, this is guitar class. Next time you come, please bring a guitar with you. And then he said, go sit in the back of the room and, you know, listen to and watch what we're doing today. So I went in the back of the room, and other students were coming in and talking to him, and a young woman came in, and she had a piece of paper something else, and he talked to her and pointed to the back of the room, and she walked back, and she saw me sitting there in the back row by myself with my green, you know, kind of a fatigue jacket, kind of looking the role of being a veteran. And she moved as far away from me as she could. And I caught her on the way out of class that first day because I kind of was attracted to this young woman. And we've been married 42 years. And so I always tell that story because I think one of the important things is that a lot of people came back to not just tough situations the day they came back, but tough situations because of wounds or PTSD or whatever it was, and had trouble finding a job or going back to school, or, you know, so many, myself included, got, you know, Dear John letters, you know, when we were overseas. So it was really, really tough on a lot of people, and I always think that it's important that we keep that in mind when we talk to veterans. We don't know what their story was or how hard it was for them. Phil, do you want to pick up on that, you know, why Vietnam still matters? You want to?
Well, I think there's lots of things. We talked about the 1 year time in Vietnam. We talk about maybe an inequity in who served in Vietnam. Been kind of getting ready for this. I kind of reread some stuff that I'd read 20 years ago or something like that about deferments, about how deferments were possible to avoid Vietnam. There were educational deferments, there were occupational deferments. The National Guard and reserves were available for people to go into and to avoid service. I think back about all the professional baseball players and professional football players, and you know, compared to World War II, where I've got a book at home about baseball during World War II, mm-hmm. and it talks about all the people from Major League Baseball that mm-hmm. served overseas.
Right.
Many of which lost their lives, wounded, changed their whole, the course of their life. Didn't happen in Vietnam. National Guard and reserve units were, they had slots that athletes went into. I don't blame them for doing it. What I do blame is I blame our government for having a National Guard and a reserve system and never using it. You know, of the million plus people that served in National Guard and Reserve units, there were only about 15,000 that were ever activated and sent to Vietnam. And that's just not right.
Well, I think that's changed, though. I mean,
oh, it has changed. And totally it changed for the right,
yeah, mm-hmm.
for the right reason, but it didn't change during Vietnam.
No. And I'm with you, because I can remember that when I got my notice to be drafted, I appealed it to my draft board, and the answer was 4-0, you're going anyway. And here I was teaching school and in graduate school at the same time. It didn't matter.
What kind of questions or anybody from the audience want to? Yeah. Hi, Jen.
In terms of how it matters now, too, I think I would assume that it had a pretty significant impact on your lives. And as you reflect back on the experiences that you had, or you know, the experiences of other people that you encountered during your service, are there ways that you feel it has had a substantial impact on the course of your life and the influence that you've subsequently had on the world?
Well, I ended up being a lifer. I spent 25 years in the military. That's the kind of impact it had on. So it kind of shaped me for 25 years. I was fortunate I didn't have to go back to Vietnam, but kind of set the path.
How about you, Kathy?
I think it had a huge influence. My husband was in the military, but ended up, he just didn't get sent to Vietnam. He was a medic, and I met him in the Army. We fraternized, which, you know, I was the officer, he was the enlisted. We weren't supposed to do that. But I only bring that up because subsequently we had a son and daughter both join the military, and both of them went to both Iraq and Afghanistan. And my son-in-law is about to go back to Iraq for his third tour of Iraq, and he had two in Afghanistan. And I think that's a hard thing now, is that there's the people who are going to deployments now keep getting sent back and sent back. And the Army goes not less than 9 months, but usually for a year. And when you do that back to back, or, you know, you're home 3, 5, 6 months and you go back again, it's very, very difficult. And I think that that did not happen as much in Vietnam, to my knowledge. I know some fellows did re-up for another tour, but that was more voluntary. And there's no choice in it now because they don't have as many to draw on. They really, part of it is intentional. I think they've not recruited as much. But I see big changes, and that's how it influenced my life, is we ended up being very pro-service-oriented for our children, and two of ours ended, we have a large family, and just two of them ended up going.
I've been back to Vietnam five times in the last 5 years, and I'm working on a documentary that'll be on WTIU next fall that'll tell stories about the war from the point of view of the former enemies. So while I've been in Vietnam, my goal has been to interview VC and North Vietnamese regular Army veterans. And I've interviewed about 40 people. It's kind of an awkward interview because it's culturally and language barriers to try to get content. But almost every veteran that I've met in Vietnam, if I've interviewed them in their home, they invite you in and they give you usually tea, sometimes something a little stronger, and then they look at you and through the interpreter they say, why do you care about the Vietnam War? Why do you Americans want to know about the American War? We liberated the country in 1975 and we've moved on. And it's interesting, so I have to tell them that I think that we need to understand history from different points of view. I'd like to know why, you know, there was a soldier opposite Bill Zook or any of you guys. Why was it, what's that person's feelings? You know, what were they thinking about? Why did they fight? And what did they do when the war ended? And it's been really, really an interesting adventure of this project. So hopefully you'll get a chance to see that next October.
Listening to Why Vietnam Still Matters 50 Years Later on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to a panel hosted by the Monroe County History Center on why Vietnam still matters 50 years later. Veterans Phil Zook, Catherine Peacock, Jim Cryway, and Jim Follett, along with Ron Osgood, sat on the panel on November 5th. This audio was provided courtesy of Community Access Television Services. As a warning, this episode contains some sensitive material about wartime. We return now to an audience question.
I wonder how you can live with the experiences that you had. How do things still today remind you of something that happened, and how do you go on with your life after experiencing what had to be horrors that we who didn't go don't have any idea what you experienced?
Let me preface it before any of them decide to tell their stories, because I've interviewed 150 Vietnam veterans for this project, American and North Vietnamese, and I've interviewed a number of Americans who have said to me at the beginning of the interview, I won't talk about anything too specific. I'm not going to tell you the stories that I've never told my family that nobody knows. And I remember one man telling me, he said, I can tell you the story today, but for the next 2 weeks, my life is going to be just absolutely miserable because it's going to bring back to him the memories that he didn't want to have to relive. So sometimes people are really reluctant to tell. And other people, it's really, really good for them to tell their story. And I've interviewed a number of people whose wives were in the room when I did the interview off to the side, and I've had a couple that came up to me afterwards and said, I didn't know hardly anything that he told you. I'd never heard any of those stories before. And so I think it was really, really good for them to tell their stories. And it was good for the family and the wife in those cases to be able to hear those stories. So I wanted to preface that before anyone wants to tell any stories about that, the trauma you carry.
Well, post-traumatic stress is a real phenomenon, and I think that most combat veterans have it to some degree. It can be dealt with. I can remember the first 15 years after my Vietnam, my military experience, I didn't deal with it. I didn't deal with it at all. And it was only after I realized that by not dealing with it, I was creating more of a problem for myself than I would if I did deal with it. It's kind of the concept that those bad memories you want to just keep locked away and don't deal with them. But they don't go away in that respect. And by going to the Veterans Administration, by going through some counseling, by sorting out some memories, by meeting with other veterans, guys that I served with, it's been a benefit to dealing with the experiences that I went through. And I spent 6 months basically as a ground pounder on the ground. I was wounded twice. The second time put me in the hospital for 3.5 months. There were 26 men that were killed. There were more than 60 that were wounded the 6 months that I was there. So experienced a lot of loss. But the other thing that you kind of forget is there's great camaraderie in the military. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to imagine, but in the jungle, in a combat situation, you could have had some of the best experiences as far as it goes for relating to people and just to experience heroism, to see heroism exhibited by somebody else, that does something that just, seems remarkable. And even after years of thinking about it, you still think what made that guy to get up and go across that open field? And that's some of the things that helped me deal with it. I think it's been said about all wars. I mean, you wouldn't take $1 million for your experiences, but you wouldn't pay a dime for any more of it than what you had. It's kind of that way for somebody who's gone through combat experience.
I had trouble with PTSD, and when I first came back, I'd gone for some personal counseling, and they wondered why I had not been debriefed or anything. Yeah, and I says, well, they did. Nobody said anything about it. I was just released, And I know that there's little things in the back of my brain that are just there. And my first really bad flashback was 25 years after I got back. And there's three things that happened. And when they were put together, it brought up an incident, and it just blew my mind. And I had trouble with sleep difficulties and crying and being nervous. It lasted 2 weeks. And it just caught me by surprise. I thought, that was 25 years ago. And yet, it's there. And I've had some other ones that weren't quite that bad. But I realized that deep in here, there's something there that's gone on. I had a chaplain's assistant that was with me at Quezon, and he was just a lovable guy, and about 5 minutes after he was with me, he was killed. And the chaplain came, we just sat there and sat down and hung our heads and didn't talk for a while. It was just one of those things.
Other comments or questions? Let's kind of just do a quick one through on any last stories or things. Phil, you got anything, any other?
Share. Ron and I had an experience. One of the guys that in my platoon that was killed on the day that I was wounded, 24th of May, the paper, local paper, did an article about me back in 1990, and came out as a nice article, and it was when I was kind of coming out, and I wanted to make contact with guys I'd served with. And that night I got a call, and the gentleman on the phone said, read the article about you in the paper, and we saw that you were wounded on the 24th of May, and our nephew was killed on the 24th of May. Is there any possibility that you would have known him? My head's kind of spinning at the time. And he says his name was Nick Taylor. Well, Nick was next to me. Mm. He was killed by the mortar round that wounded me. And the person that was on the phone was his uncle, lives here in Bloomington. And he put me in touch after a period of time with Nick's mother, who lived in central Illinois. And after writing her a letter about Nick, and then she invited me to come to Illinois and to visit with her. And I remember driving over and thinking, there's a lot of things I want to do, but I don't really want to do this. But I was so wrong. She did more for helping me deal with my experiences than what I did for her. Now, she's deceased now, but she would probably say the opposite. We had a wonderful experience. And here, as recently as last May, I was in touch with Nick's sister. And in the conversation, she said something about visiting Nick's grave. And I said, well, I've been there three times recently. And the last time was on the 24th of May, a couple years ago. And she said, would you come back on the day that Nick was killed? And Ron and I went over there. And it was really a wonderful experience. He came from a small town. There was probably 15 family members that were there. And so many people from the town that remembered Nick from growing up, 19-year-old when he was killed. And we stood by his graveside. I got a chance to kind of talk about Nick. And there was a prayer said. And we sang Amazing Grace, and then we all had dinner together. And I bring that story up not to, you know, in any way kind of talk about what I've done, but some of the hardest things that you think you need to do or you have to do can be the most beneficial to you. And I've received so much love from Nick's family and from some of the other next of kin that I've been able to be in touch with.
Anybody else?
Yeah, something happened to me. I was reading an article in the American Legion magazine. It was by a woman who was lamenting the fact that her father was killed and she didn't have somebody to walk her down the aisle. And I knew her father. And I didn't remember the day he was killed. And she was maybe two or three years old, I don't remember, when he was killed. So she had no recollection of him. When I was in Vietnam, I took about 400 feet of film, and I put it on a CD, and I sent it to her. So she would have some idea what it was like and what he went through.
Anybody else want to add anything or any other comments or questions? Yes, Aaron.
This has been amazing, but this might sound bad. These stories are kind of, they're heavy, you know. My dad was a veteran. He served in the first Gulf War, and he was in the National Guard for 30 years, and he has some hilarious stories, you know. There had to be some kind of levity that when you're with your buddies, you know, serving, and, you know, you could be, I don't know, just waiting for Charlie to show up or whatever, but there had to be some kind of levity there to kind of lighten the low a little. Do you have any of those kind of stories that you could share that are, I guess I should say, PG enough that could be recorded?
I have a cartoon over there. When the French were over there at Dien Bien Phu, they tunneled underneath the military compound that the French had, the Vietnamese did. And so we were at caisson and had been there for a while, and all of a sudden, some guys came running up to me, and they said, we can hear people digging underneath us. And so you can imagine what we all thought. I got my stethoscope out, which is what the cartoon is about, and put it on the ground. And sure enough, you could hear people digging underneath me. And so, you know, I went and got our CO and was and told him what I'd found. And he said, well, he says, that's our troops. They're so scared they're digging down there as deep as they can get. And so the picture there shows
that's funny.
People digging. And I have a stethoscope on the ground listening to it.
I can think of something that was kind of funny. Easter Sunday, I was flying in Vietnam, and I had the division chaplain on board, and we were going to different fire bases, and unfortunately we got shot down. And that was the last time he got in a helicopter. He'd never get back in a helicopter. And on Christmas, I flew around Vietnam handing out ice cream. I had a loads of ice cream on board, and we went from fire base to fire base.
You got a Santa, too, right?
Ice cream.
Is there a Santa Claus on board?
Yes, yeah. Santa Claus
somebody
was on
dressed
board.
As Santa? The ones that I, that, some of the men that I have interviewed said, when I would ask them if they'd ever seen, if they ever saw Americans, and some would say, oh, yeah, we saw them, but they didn't see us. Mm-hmm. We were camouflaged, hidden. But they wouldn't make contact with an American a lot. They didn't, a lot of the guys, they didn't, they're just like us, they didn't really want to.
They want to fight.
Mm-hmm. But they would say some of them were intimidated by Americans because Americans were big and we were so well equipped, you know, they said, they would say the artillery or the uniforms to some of them, it was unique. They would talk about getting sprayed, what it was like to feel that coming down and not knowing what it was and then finally realizing when they would see the defoliation, how long would that take?
Oh, for the defoliate? Well, yeah. The blue that we used on rice, 24 hours, yeah. it'd turn it brown.
Right.
But the Agent Orange, it'd take maybe a week, 10 days.
Yeah, they had to get their roots.
They would say once they started seeing that happen, they realized they had to figure out ways to carry, you know, some kind of cloth and, you know, use it as a mask and dampen it in the water. But how could they get food and what would they eat? And it's really, really interesting. Well, I want to thank all the panelists for spending their Saturday afternoon when they could be at home watching the IU football game or something like that.
Just finished listening to a panel discussion entitled Why Vietnam Still Matters 50 Years Later. This panel took place on November 5th at the Monroe County History Center. Panelists discussed their service in Vietnam along with what it was like to return home. Veterans Phil Duke, Catherine Peacock, Jim Criway, and Jim Follett were panelists, while veteran and filmmaker Ron Osgood moderated the panel. The audio for today was provided courtesy of Community Access Television Services.
Been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.